Please rise. Court is now in session. Please be seated.
Good afternoon, Council. Ready to proceed?
Members of the Chief Justice, members of the Court. Our brief raised three issues in this case. My argument this afternoon will focus primarily on the second and third issue, the Getz issue and the 609 issue. Consideration of these two issues is premised to a large extent on the fact that this was a painfully close case. On the third day of deliberations, the jury reported that they were deadlocked at 6 to 6. 27 hours later, they came back and my client was convicted of murder. Everyone knew that this was going to be a close case as we approached the trial. The state recognized that its two main witnesses, Bonilla Tan and Earl Evans, were going to have major credibility problems, and they desperately needed to shore up their credibility. To that end, they hoped to introduce ballistics evidence to support the witnesses' claims that the gun found at Abbey Walk a month after the murder was the murder weapon. The state's ballistics examiner could say that the gun at Abbey Walk had traits similar to the murder weapon, but he couldn't say that it was the gun. But it was the state's hope to introduce the evidence that the gun was the murder weapon, that it was seized as part of a robbery investigation, and Mr. Haney pled guilty to that robbery investigation. So as we started litigating these issues, in their memorandum of law to the trial court, they framed the issue as a 404B issue. They argued that the admission of the robbery conviction, along with the weapon, was admissible to prove opportunity, knowledge, absence of mistake, and identity. And those, as we know, are the criteria for admission of another bad act under Rule 404B. In the state's answering brief to this court, in this appeal, they assert that the possession of the gun was neither a crime or a bad act. That's on page 21 of their brief. Well, I'm pretty sure that the jury saw it as a bad act. After all, the gun was seized by the police as part of a search at Abbey Walk. The police didn't return it to Mr. Haney or Mr. Evans when they seized it. Instead, they confiscated it. So I think most jurors would view that scenario as a bad act on the part of the defendant. As such, when used for proving identity, the evidence should have qualified for a Getz instruction. And the defense didn't ask for a Getz instruction. And the question is, why not? Well, Mr. Hyden and I have tried to reconstruct our thought process. We had fought a protracted battle to keep out the ballistics evidence. I should tell you that as the issue was first framed for us, we thought that the state had no other way to authenticate the gun other than the ballistics evidence. In other words, we found a gun at Abbey Walk. The ballistics match the ballistics from the, or close to the ballistics at the murder scene. Therefore, the gun should come in. And we drafted our motion in limine based on that premise. And we were initially successful. Thereafter, we learned from the state that Tan would identify the weapon that was found at Abbey Walk as his gun, the gun that he had seen my client with on the day the murder was committed. And the state sought to re-argue the issue, saying that the ballistics evidence was needed to bolster Tan's credibility. As the issue became more focused, the defense became concerned that not only would the gun come in through the testimony of Tan and Evans, but the ballistics evidence might also be admitted. We, in effect, negotiated a settlement of the issue whereby we didn't object to the gun coming in, with the understanding there would be no ballistics testimony and no mention of the Abbey Walk robbery. And in the process, we may have let our guard down and overlooked the Getz issue. Now, I should point out that we were also taking the position that Earl Evans was the murderer and that the gun was in his possession. And that was the theory we pitched in the beginning, in the opening statement, and in the closing statement. Under that defense theory, it could perhaps be viewed as a reasonable tactical decision not to ask for a Getz instruction, since we took the position that our man never had the gun. but I want to tell you something. Neither Mr. Hyden or I can recall discussing that tactic at the time the gun was introduced. And certainly, a Getz instruction could have been crafted to address either scenario, to account for the belief that the gun was either in the possession of Evans or Haney at the time it was seized at Abbey Wall. So, as best as we can determine, this was an issue that, I regret to say, I think we just missed. When I read the transcript, the absence of the Getz instruction stood out. And I could not think of a reason as I read the transcript, nor can I think of one today, as to why we didn't ask for it at the time. So that brings us to the point where we have to discuss whether this qualifies as a, or meets the criteria for plain error. Did the lack of a Getz instruction affect the outcome of this trial? And we submit that the closeness of the case points to that conclusion. The state's case was staked on the credibility of Evans and Tan. The jury had to weigh their credibility in the context of the other evidence in this case. But the fact is, there wasn't very much other evidence in this case other than the testimony of Evans and Tan. And their testimony, as we know, as the state knows, and as the judge conceded, was extremely suspect. And that's why we feel the absence of a Getz instruction was important. My client, Jason Haney, did not testify in the trial. What the jury knew of Jason Haney, they knew from information revealed to them in the state's case. And as a result of the prejudicial gun evidence coming in without an instruction, the jury heard evidence which could be considered bad character evidence. Without the instruction, the jury was entitled to consider the evidence for whatever purpose they may have chosen, including the possibility that Haney was a person of bad character and acted in conformance therewith. So, if the jury had concerns about the credibility of Evans and Tan, and we submit they did, the jury could now, or certain members of the jury, could now counterbalance that concern about the credibility of Evans and Tan with negative character evidence about Haney. Without the Getz instruction, the jury was thus free to consider the evidence as they chose, even to support a belief that Haney acted in conformity with what they knew about his bad character. The introduction of the gun, without the instruction that the gun could not be used to determine character, may very well have tipped the balance after so many hours of deliberations and had been a factor or the factor which broke the 6-6 deadline. Put it another way, the evidence may have damaged Mr. Haney's right to be presumed innocent, a substantial constitutional right. We submit the evidence may have predisposed the jury to come to an unfair conclusion about his character, which affected the starting point of his deliberations, that Mr. Haney is presumed innocent. We submit, therefore, that the absence of a Getz instruction does meet the plain error criteria. The only issue I would like to address today is the 609 issue in which the trial court ruled that Tan's juvenile conviction of burglary could not be admitted. Had it been an adult conviction, it would have been admissible. I acknowledge that Rule 609 is clear when it says that juvenile convictions are generally not admissible. But the rule does provide an exception to the general prohibition against admissibility if, one, the person convicted is now an adult, and two, the court is satisfied that the evidence is necessary for a fair determination of guilt or innocence. Though the exception exists, I have not found a single reported Delaware case in which the exception was exercised. But I have to believe that the exception does not exist in a vacuum, that somewhere, somehow, there must be a fact situation to which this exception applies. That someday, sometime, this court will recognize that the exception to Rule 609D exists for a reason and should be utilized in an appropriate case. And we submit that today is the day, and this is the case.
What kind of criteria would a trial judge use for reaching the second part of the analysis, which is whether it's fair to admit it or not? Seems fairly obvious that you either are or aren't an adult at the time it's offered.
Right.
But what standard does one set for the trial judge, particularly when we generally review that on abuse of discretion?
Well, I would use the standard that the trial judge articulated in this case and then seemed to disregard, that the credibility of this particular witness was key to the issue of guilt or innocence. I don't think it can be said any clearer than that. And if you recognize that the credibility of a particular witness is key, then I think that that points to the exception coming into play and the admissibility of it. So that's what we had in this case. We had everybody understanding that Tan's testimony was key. His credibility was in grave dispute. And I submit that the defense should have been able to explore, however possible, whatever ammunition we had, should be able to use whatever ammunition we had to attack his credibility.
Well, didn't you already have in front of the jury the fact that he had a bunch of other convictions and things pending? I mean, if your point was to let them know that he had run-ins with the law, they certainly got that picture. Why is one more going to make a difference?
We did have a lot. We had an awful lot. Can I say one more might have made a difference? The way I look at these cases so far, I mean, let's look at the other side of the coin. What's the reason for not introducing a juvenile conviction? Although it's not articulated, I take it to mean that we're trying to protect the privacy right of a juvenile for an indiscretion or a crime that may have been committed as a juvenile. The Rhodes case, I think, is a good example of that. That was a case in which the victim committed some crimes years before he became a victim, and then he had to testify. And the court said, you know, that happened a while back. It's really not, doesn't relate to this case. There's nothing since then. We're not going to admit those juvenile indiscretions. I can understand that. But we have the Harris case, on the other hand, which says the witness had a juvenile conviction. He wasn't a key witness in the case. He was a passerby. He saw something. It's no need to get into his background to expose an indiscretion on his part to make a minor point in that case. But this case is completely different. This case, we have a witness who really doesn't need or deserve to have his privacy protected anymore. He's got plenty of convictions out there. He's got a pending charge waiting for him. He's trying to make a deal with the prosecutors. So yes, we did have a lot of information to work with, but we had more that we weren't allowed to work with. So where does that leave us? We had six jurors in a room after 3 days. Six feel one way, six feel the other way. I've never been in that situation, but I gotta believe that after 3 days, the jurors are going back and forth with each other. Well, how about this? How about that? And I don't know after 3 days what tips the scales, what convinces one jury to change his mind. This may have been it. This may have been a piece of ammunition that one of the jurors who were leaning for acquittal could have used to help sway one of the six jurors who were leaning for his conviction.
But is that the standard that we're supposed to apply? And what I'm saying, this is an abuse of discretion ruling, isn't it?
Oh, it is an abuse of discretion.
Okay, and abuse of discretion implies something greater than just, well, you know, it could have helped. I mean, which is what I think you're arguing, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not arguing what might have happened to change the case, but I don't think that what might have happened to change the case is abuse of discretion. I think abuse of discretion says, what were the facts here? What reasons? The way I'm posing this question, what issue was paramount in the court's mind? Was it the privacy concerns of Monia Tan, who really didn't need a lot of privacy protection? Or was it the grave need of my client to attack the key witness in this case, however way was fair?
Well, this wouldn't be one of those cases, would it, Mr. Capone? Think big softball here. Where we have concluded in the past that, well, the trial judge erred, but the plain error standard still isn't met because it really wouldn't, in the whole scope of things, made a difference in the outcome.
Look, I came in here that's the first argument, which I'm not arguing, was pretty much the setup for the second and third argument. This case was so close, I can't say what made a difference. Everything mattered in the case where the jury vote comes back on 3 days later and says, we're tied at 6-6. Everything is important. So I don't think you can say that in this case. This is a case where I think it's critically important. If the jury had come back in 20 minutes and, and found my client guilty, it's a different story. I'm not here. I'm not making the argument. This is a painfully close case. And this court, and I wish I could remember the case off the top of my head, but I can't. This court has recognized that close cases deserve closer looks. And that's what we have here. So that's why I feel the 609 issue has relevance and importance to this particular case.
Did you want to save your rebuttal or keep going?
I'm done. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court. I'll attempt to address the two arguments that have been raised in the oral argument today, but if the court has any questions about the first argument, which was the sufficiency of the evidence for the five convictions, I'll certainly try to answer those as well. The state's position on the second argument is that there was not plain error in this particular case because the trial judge did not sua sponte give a jury limiting instruction when the handgun was introduced into evidence. This is a 38 Cobra special that Mona Tan, one of the prosecution witnesses, authenticated as being his handgun. He testified that he recognized the gun because some of the paint or finish had been worn off on one portion of it, and he also noted in his testimony at trial that the insignia that identified it as a Cobra model, that particular imprint was discolored, and that's how he was able to say that in fact was his handgun, even though it was found by the police approximately 3 weeks after this attempted murder homicide, and was found not at Mr. Tan's residence but at the residence of another prosecution witness, Mr. Earl Evans, where Mr. Haney was apparently staying. The expert ballistics evidence in this case, as has been indicated, ultimately didn't pan out. About all that they were able to say was that the gun that was introduced into evidence was the same caliber, a 38 caliber, but no one was able to testify to a reasonable scientific certainty that that was the gun that had been used in the 2001 fatal shooting of Mr. Mercer in this particular case. So what was done in order to introduce the evidence was to have Mr. Tan authenticate the firearm that had been seized by the police. The facts are a little unusual in this case because what had happened was the homicide occurred August 21st of 2001. There was a separate investigation, I guess, of Mr. Evans or Mr. Hall, his roommate, that took place the following month, where the Wilmington police officers went to Mr. Evans and Mr. Hall's apartment where Mr. Haney was staying, and they were investigating an entirely separate matter. They weren't investigating this homicide. At that time, they seized the handgun that's at issue here, and that was found in the living room in some possessions of Mr. Haney that apparently were located there. In this particular case, the state really has two arguments. One, that the simple possession alone of a handgun is not a bad act that qualifies under 404B. This court in Stevenson, in 1998 decision, indicated as much, that the simple possession of a firearm for personal protection is not either a crime or a bad act. There was no indication in any of the testimony that Mr. Haney was a person prohibited, so that the simple possession of the firearm would not have been a crime either. So in this particular case, if it doesn't qualify as a crime or a bad act, then 404B is not even implicated, nor is the Getz analysis implicated. The other argument that the state would make is that if for some reason it's still perceived to be a bad act in some sense, the trial judge was not sua sponte required to give a limiting instruction to the jury. That is an instruction to the effect that simply because this handgun was found in Mr. Haney's possession, the juror should not assume that Mr. Haney is a bad person or otherwise predisposed to commit criminal actions. There are cases, and I've cited the cases and attached two or three of the orders to the state's brief, that indicate that the failure of the trial judge to sua sponte give a limiting instruction when one might otherwise be required is not necessarily error, and certainly not plain error in this case, which is the standard here, because there was no request, and Rule 105 of the Delaware Rules of Evidence indicate that if you're asking that evidence be admitted only for a limited purpose, it's incumbent upon you, or you're objecting to evidence being admitted for more than one purpose, it's incumbent upon you as the party objecting to request a limiting instruction. That was not done here, so that's why we're in a plain error standard of review.
Can you clarify the precise purpose for which the gun was admitted into evidence?
Yeah, I think the purpose was that Mona Tan had testified that he had a handgun at his apartment in Wilmington, that the gun was loaded, and that he noticed on the day of the homicide that Mr. Haney had taken his gun from I believe it was a kitchen cabinet, and had the gun in his possession, had Mona Tan's gun in his possession, when Mr. Tan drove Haney over to Mr. Mercer, the homicide victim's residence in Wilmington. He said he saw the gun later that day, that Mr. Haney apparently put the gun back in the cabinet at Mr. Tan's residence. But sometime between then, August 21, and when the police came to Mr. Tan's residence on September 9, the gun was not there. Now, Mr. Tan did say that Mr. Haney was back at his residence the following day, but it was never known exactly when the gun somehow got from Mr. Tan's residence over to the Abbey Walk apartment where Mr. Haney was staying with Evans and Mr. Hall. But the purpose, I think, was to show that, yes, in fact, there was a gun. Mr. Tan was able to authenticate the gun and say that the gun that was introduced as State's Exhibit 1 was in fact his gun. So I think that was the evidentiary connection here between the weapon and the other testimony, the other incriminatory testimony of Mr. Tan, that Mr. Haney was in fact in possession of a handgun at the time that he went to Mr. Mercer's residence.
From which the jury could conclude that that was the murder weapon.
Well, I think they could conclude that two of the charges were possession of a firearm during commission of felony, so the state had to show that he did, in fact, have possession of a firearm. Those were elements of at least two of the offenses here. The other side, Mr. Haney's argument relies upon this court's 1997 decision in Farmer. However, I think Farmer is both factually and legally distinguishable. In Farmer, what happened was the police were investigating another shooting. They discovered Mr. Farmer was in possession of a firearm, but there was never any nexus or connection between the firearm that was recovered and the weapon that was used in the alleged shooting by Mr. Farmer. And this court, I think, rightfully concluded that, well, when you don't have any evidentiary nexus or connection here, it is prejudicial to introduce a firearm in that particular context. However, here there is an evidentiary connection. Certainly the testimony of Mr. Tan that in fact was his gun, and the additional testimony I've elaborated on, that Mr. Tan observed Mr. Haney in possession of his gun when he drove Mr. Haney over to Mercer's residence that day. So I think that's both the factual and the legal distinction here, is that there is a palpable evidentiary connection between the handgun and the crimes that are being alleged. Addressing the third argument, it's the state's position that there was not an abuse of discretion by the trial judge in declining to permit the additional evidence that prosecution witness Mania Tan, his prior juvenile conviction for a burglary, should not be admitted as impeachment evidence here. As has been already mentioned, Evidentiary Rule 609 explicitly states that juvenile delinquency adjudications generally are not admissible, the exception being that if it is necessary for a fair determination of issues of guilt or innocence, then it can be, but it's a matter of the trial judge's exercise of discretion. The trial judge here did apply the proper evidentiary standard. He made reference to 609 and what its requirements are in this particular case. And it's the state's position that there has been no showing that the trial judge abused his discretion in this instance. As has already been discussed, there was substantial other evidence from which to impeach Mr. Tan's credibility as a witness, because he did have adult felony convictions, as well as his impartiality as a witness in this particular case. Admittedly, he offered highly incriminatory testimony against Mr. Haney, but the jury also heard during Mr. Tan's actual direct testimony that he had prior Virginia adult convictions for charges. One was eluding the police, and then a second charge for receiving stolen goods felony. So they knew that he had these Virginia adult convictions. In addition, they were also told, the jury was also told in this case, that Mr. Tan had two sets of robbery charges that were pending here in Delaware at the time of this particular trial. And Mr. Tan acknowledged that he was potentially facing substantial imprisonment time or jail time if he was convicted of one or both of those robbery charges as well. So in this particular case, the jury was exposed to substantial impeaching evidence from which to judge Mr. Tan's credibility and impartiality as a prosecution witness. There was not an abuse of discretion under these particular circumstances in the judge excluding the additional juvenile adjudication in this instance. As I've indicated, I don't think there's that much more that would have been added here. The jury ultimately was going to have to assess the credibility of Mr. Tan, assess the credibility of Mr. Evans, who were the two primary incriminatory witnesses that the state produced. And both of those individuals had adult criminal convictions. They were both convicted felons. So the jury had to assess credibility in this case, and that's what they did. Admittedly, the jury was out for a long time. It was a difficult case, but it was also a very serious case. It was a prosecution for two counts of first-degree murder, and I think that may explain some of the dynamics of what went on here. But on balance, I don't think in either instance the first argument about the limiting instruction that Mr. Haney has shown any particular plain error here, and it is his burden as the appellant raising this issue for the first time on appeal to show that this would have affected the outcome of the trial, nor has Mr. Haney shown an abuse of discretion by the trial judge in this particular instance. It might be different and certainly a more compelling argument if the only impeaching evidence that could have been presented regarding Mr. Tan's credibility was this juvenile conviction, but that was not the case here. There was substantial other evidence, and that was more than sufficient in this particular case.
Mr. Williams, you mentioned that the trial judge got the standard correct in 609. What's your understanding of why the trial judge exercised his discretion and excluded the juvenile conviction, as opposed to taking the same factual basis you just explained and say, well, what the heck? It might as well come on in. Who knows what impact it may have on the jury, but given the rest of Mr. Tan's record, I'm hardly protecting him from himself by letting this juvenile record become public. Well, how did this trial judge draw the line the way in which he did it?
Well, I think what he did in this particular case was he you first enunciated what the general rule is, and the general rule is that the juvenile convictions are not admissible. That was his starting point, and I think he specifically referred to Rule 609. And then he said, you know, here's the exception. Is it necessary for a fair determination of guilt or innocence in this particular case? And the context in which it came up, I think, was before the witness had testified, the trial judge asked counsel, well, what evidence do we have about prior records? What impeaching evidence do you want to offer so I can make a ruling before the witness is presented to the jury about what is or isn't going to be admissible? In terms of further elucidating what all the basis was, I don't think the judge did that. I think he stopped in saying, well, I don't find that it's necessary for a fair determination of guilt or innocence here.
Yeah, I'm trying to get to why did he reach that conclusion. Yeah.
And I think, and this is certainly my argument, not what the trial judge said, but I think what he said, or the reason he said what he said, was because of this other evidence, that there was indication that there was going to be evidence from Virginia about the Virginia convictions. I don't know if that was the second part was discussed or not, but when it came out, there was also testimony, which probably affects more impartiality as opposed to credibility since they weren't yet convictions, but that he was facing two sets of robbery charges here in Delaware, and that those carried potential or substantial potential jail time. So I think that was the whole mix, and when you go back and look at it, did the trial judge abuse his discretion? I think the conclusion is no. Could he have elaborated more in ruling on it or laying out the standard? Yes, I think he certainly could have, but I think what he did was appropriate under the circumstances, and I think given all of the evidence that was presented, I don't think looking at it in retrospect that this court could say that that was ultimately an abuse of discretion.
Well, let's assume that we don't know precisely why he weighed the second point the way he did, but it could have gone either way for the sake of argument. In a case that Mr. Capone says was as close as this one, how do you weigh under a plain error issue, or how do you weigh that abuse of discretion, if there is one, in terms of the closeness of this case? How would you evaluate whether the jury's knowledge of this burglary conviction as a juvenile, how would that have played out?
Well, I don't know, because there isn't a quantifiable calculus you can apply here and say, okay, here's the scales and they're fairly even, and if we add one more thing, it's going to tip it in favor of the defendant. It's just not that exact.
Well, I take Mr. Capone's point to be, but if you're ever going to get a scale that's weighed 6-6, however we found out about that, this must be the case. How do you respond to that?
Well, I've given up trying to explain what juries do. I don't know why they were 6-6, if this made a difference or that made a difference. That, I think, gets into the realm of speculation, and that's really the whole problem here. Are we going to speculate that this was enough to tip the scale or that was enough
to tip the scale? Well, isn't that precisely what the trial judge is asked to do in the second prong of the 609 analysis of the juvenile conviction? Try to determine on that inexplicable calculus you're talking about whether it's fair and necessary to let it in?
Well, I think certainly that's part of it. If he's going to rule that this is one of the exceptions or not, what was indicated in the beginning argument here today was that there weren't any Delaware cases, or opposing counsel hadn't found any Delaware cases where a judge had actually done that and found the exception. And I suspect, although I haven't obviously read all those cases, but I suspect the rationale is, well, they didn't stop committing crimes when they were juveniles. There's adult records, and people ought to be a little more responsible when they're adults than they are in juveniles, and that's why we're going to automatically let the adult convictions in, assuming they're within 10 years. And once you have that, if you're a felon, you're a felon, and the jury knows that, and it's simply a question of degree after that. And if you're talking about juvenile convictions, a jury probably is going to view that in a different context than an adult conviction. And some of this obviously just involves speculation, but I don't think, given the fact that it's the other side's burden to show abuse of discretion and a plain error claim, it's certainly the other side's burden to show that that ultimately affected the outcome here, that Mr. Haney has sustained either burden in this particular case. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you have 4 minutes and 33 seconds to let us have it.
I think I'll have 4 minutes left over. In response to Justice Jacobs' question regarding the second issue, my opponent laid out for you the importance of Monaitan's testimony better than I did. Monaitan provided information that he was present at the scene when the murder was committed and said, this gun that was found in the possession of my client was the gun I saw him with at the time of the murder. That points out to the court, I hope, exactly how important he was, Monaitan was, to the state's case. That's why the trial judge said his testimony is key to what happens in this case. And that's why, in regards to the third issue, the defense should have been allowed to use whatever it had to try to discredit that witness. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.